This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
What this means is that they were incapable of 26. Children were. We see that men who had newborns
still struggling with. There's evidence in, say, schizophrenia where you see reductions of a vasopressin potentially, and there's a variety of other disorders like central diabetes insipidus where you have, reduced vasopressin signaling. But I think the jury's still out, and, you know, we have a lot of work to do in neurological and psychiatric disorders.
Yes. Thank you, Karen. Thank
you. The next question is for Sue Carter. Recent studies have reported conflicting findings on oxytocin, with some suggesting it may also amplify negative social cues in certain contexts. Right. What are your thoughts on these findings, and how might they inform our understanding of oxytocin's role in social behavior?
Well, it's a very good question. Also, it's one that comes up a lot, because simply finding a hormone or giving a hormone doesn't tell us about the receptors, and it doesn't tell us where it's working. And those who are in this field are struggling, I'd say, with the lack of a real way of telling what the target is doing. We have problems in measuring the molecules, and we have problems in figuring out where they're working. I think those apparent exceptions aren't exceptions at all. I think they're the way the system works in a person who's been through a lot of stress, who's upregulated the vasopressin receptor probably. And so oxytocin can talk to either receptors. A couple of people have said that. Until we have a better way of indexing the status of the receiver, we can't draw these conclusions. They've mostly been made by people who got kind of misled, I think, by oxytocin, entranced by the idea that it should do certain things. And of course, whatever it does is exactly what it should do. In other words, the biology is always right. In my experience, the data are always right, but our way of looking at it may need to change. Now, who's next here? Eduardo. I think I've been negligent in not thanking everybody. I want to say, I think these were pretty amazing talks. I've learned a lot. So for somebody who's thoroughly obsessed with these topics, I learned every one of them had something I didn't know. The question for Eduardo is, what's special about South America that gave rise to these pair bonding monkey species?
It's a fascinating question. But since the question comes right after you, Sue, are thanking us all, I'm sure I'm talking on behalf of all my colleagues. We're thankful to Carta, to Pascal, to everyone at UCSD. It's an amazing opportunity. I'm thrilled at the opportunity of taking in these questions and also listening to you guys. So thanks to you.
I wish this were in person. I am really.
The next one. Let's do the next one in person.
But please tell us what you think about South.
It's an excellent question, and it is true. It's something that I'm hoping that before I retire, I'll consolidate a group of people who really make it their goal to look at TD monkeys and owl monkeys in a completely integrated way. These things take a long time. I think we've taken with my group some steps in at all the times comparing them. Things changed in the last 30 years. When I started in this business, and I was studying the same TD monkeys that Karen now studies at Davis, when we would talk to taxonomists, TD monkeys and owl monkeys would be in the phylogeny of primates, in the tree of life for primates, they would be as closely related to each other as they could be. They were classified taxonomically in the same family, in the same subfamily. What I'm saying with that is that, okay, here we had two genera of primates. They are about the same size, roughly 3 pounds, a kilo, kilo and a half for each. They're both territorial, both have very little sexual dimorphism. They live in pairs, they establish pair bonds, and they have amazing paternal care. Okay, so here we have an episode of these syndromes appearing, evolving once, and giving rise to these phenotypes in these two genera. Our colleagues, the molecular geneticists, have changed that picture. And I always joke with them. I mean, they always change the landscape every 10 years, and then 10 years later, they come and tell us that we have to start again. But right now, they will say that TD monkeys and owl monkeys are relatively distantly related. So for me, the fascinating question is that if you don't have TD monkeys and owl monkeys as closely related as morphologists will still say, then you're really talking about, it's very unlikely that this is an ancestral state. It is much more likely that there's some kind of convergence in the patterns that have appeared in TD monkeys and owl monkeys. Owl monkeys these days are kind of sometimes more closely line up with calitricids, which do have a lot of paternal care, as I think was Karen describing them or mentioning them, and I also think Lee mentioned them. It is, and they also have pair bonds, of course. It is not just pair living. So I don't think we have in any other primate the kind of pattern that we see, as the person asking the question posed, the pattern we see in South America. It's the Latin lovers, I would say. That would be my simple answer to the question. But no, it's fascinating. And I think that what we're hoping, we have some fantastic data to start looking at genomes. And ideally, maybe in the next 10 years, we can do some functional genomics work as well to really compare the biological basis of these behaviors in the two genera. Because in the field, my goodness, the convergence is remarkable.
Thank you very much.
It's remarkable. How you get to having the infant more attached to the father than the mother, as Karen was stating today, into these monkeys and not somewhere in between them, what are the sociological, environmental factors that generated that? I don't know.
Thank you. The next question is for Jim Rilling. How do the neural and behavioral mechanisms underlying grandmother-child emotional regulation differ from mother-child interactions? And what cultural and evolutionary factors might explain these differences?
Yeah, hi, everybody. It's wonderful to be here. And I too, got a great deal out of the talks. We know that, so for example, you know, oxytocin is critically involved in maternal caregiving as well. So we know that from a lot of research done in animal models like rodents, that when female mammals go through pregnancy, they experience increases in estradiol that induce oxytocin receptors, and that the oxytocin that's released at parturition and also when breastfeeding, it stimulates those oxytocin receptors, and that's important for mother-infant bonding. And we also know that oxytocin is working on a kind of a global parental caregiving system that involves this critical region in the hypothalamus called the medial preoptic area. And that connects with the mesolimbic dopamine reward system that seems to be involved in the motivation to approach and nurture offspring. And so it looks as though this kind of parental caregiving system is kind of a global parental caregiving system that's used not just by mothers, but also by fathers. And, you know, we've actually done a neuroimaging study with grandmothers, and, you know, we're seeing a lot of similarity between grandmothers and mothers and fathers as well. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap. And so what we're trying to do here is assess whether it's also the case that oxytocin is involved in grand maternal caregiving, and we have some initial kind of tentative evidence in support of that. But I think we really need to do some careful longitudinal studies where we track changes in women over their transition to grandmotherhood to really verify that.
Thanks very much.
Next, yes, for Constantina. Given that oxytocin receptors are expressed in various brain regions, including auditory and vocal learning circuits, how do you propose distinguishing oxytocin's role in social motivation for learning from its potential effects on auditory perception and processing? I can read that again if you need to. That's a pretty sophisticated question.
Yeah, no, indeed, this is a really sophisticated question and one that has been worrying us for a long while. I'm finding that this question actually includes several different questions within it. One being, well, how can we really disentangle social, or as I'm calling them, social reward pathways from other sensory motor pathways? These social communication behaviors like vocal learning, vocal-based communication that I explained in my lecture are basically social behaviors. So how can we really disentangle these two aspects? So one of the experiments that we have been doing in the laboratory with Zebra Fintis, and now a graduate student from City College, is actually finishing up this work. So I will be looking forward to sharing these results as soon as possible, is that we are trying to really remove all the social aspects from what would be a vocal learning process. How do we do that? We have Zebra Fintis reared in an isolation context where they're actually hearing singing from loudspeakers. So this singing is not sung by someone, by their father, for example, which is what is usually done in Zebra Fintis. It is emitted by loudspeaker. So we are testing how they learn in such cases versus from their father, and which is the impact of oxytocin in either case, and the antagonism of oxytocin. So I think there are experimentally possible ways to disentangle between social and sensory motor, in this case, vocal aspects. Now, the other question, which was, I guess, kind of like the conclusive question of the question, is how can we separate out between the social kind of reward aspect and how it plays a role in auditory versus vocal learning development. So I think they are one of the best experiments in the oxytocin world. Indeed, comes from vocal learning songbirds again, where developmentally they measured the upregulation of the oxytocin receptor in several auditory and vocal learning regions across development. And what's very important for zebra finches is that we have a very clear knowledge that the very first days of their lives, let's say for day zero to day 30, 40 or so, they only undergo what we call auditory learning. They do not really try out any vocalizations. They only produce some calls, but not fully fledged vocalizations. They're not even bubbling. After day 40 until day 90 of their lives, they try out their vocalizations, they're bubbling, they're forming their first kind of stereotype vocalizations. And then by day 90 or 100, they have fully acquired the song that they will be singing for the rest of their lives. So by testing out how the oxytocin receptor is expressed in different brain pathways in these different time windows, we could try to disentangle between auditory and vocal mechanisms. Now, the social aspects of it, I think it is really difficult to really, in a naturalistic environment as the one that we would be studying, it is very difficult to disentangle between the social aspect and the auditory aspect. We try to do it in the vocal experimental paradigm by having the songbirds learned by loudspeaker. But other than that, I think that this is the best that we can do.
Thank you very much. I have a question for Ruth Feldman, who is not joining us now because of the late hour, but I do have her answer to it, so I will share that with you. The question is as follows. You mentioned that these foundations start with the mother-infant relationship and then are built upon in other relationships and with other groups. As humans have been able to form larger groups and more complex social networks than any other species, can you comment on what changes in love-hate biology may have aided in this development? So Ruth answers, humans form more social connections and have more complex mechanisms for understanding others' distress than any other species. Those connections, according to our model, rely on the capacity for synchrony. We are prone to coordinate our actions, but also our neural processes with other members of our species, both familiar and strangers. And the capacity for synchrony is imprinted in the brain in the context of maternal care as well, in slightly different ways, as our study of gay parents raising their infants without maternal involvement shows. The love-hate biology, both built on the same foundations, help us form bonds, but also synchronize with others to protect our loved ones. And this quickly turns into hatred and destruction. Like any other evolutionary expansion, this love-turned-hatred biology made humans not only the most collaborative species, but also the most destructive one. We kill our conspecifics not only for immediate food or tangible resources, but also for our abstract attachments to spread our religion or our way of doing things, for example, democracy. Unfortunately, even 30 seconds of watching the news can give us a view of humans' destructiveness in the name of love.
Okay, the next question's for Lee. Is there research investigating whether variation in the extent of a father's testosterone reduction during childcare is associated with changes in his child's own testosterone level or broader hormone profiles? And they ask, how might such variations influence the child's developmental trajectory and behavior? Great question, Lee. Take it away.
That is a really good question. So in the context of the talk I gave today, I wasn't able to discuss some of our newer research from the longitudinal study in the Philippines that just came out in the last couple of years. But one of the things that we've been able to do is go back to the data that were collected in the early 1980s and the 1990s and kind of extract information about the caregiving environments that the boys experienced when they were really young, when they were in middle childhood, when they were adolescents, experiences with both their parents, but particularly with their dads. And what we have found, so we don't have hormonal data from the boys when they're growing up back in the 80s and 90s, nor do we have hormonal data from their own dads from that time point. We didn't start collecting those data till the mid 2000s. But what we know is that if boys grew up with a dad who was present in their household and helping to take care of them, which wasn't the typical role for dads. I talked a fair amount about cultural variation and the role of fathers across societies. In the 80s and 90s, Filipino fathers on average were really invested in their families, but they didn't do a lot of childcare with young kids. They've shifted, this current generation of dads, there's been a shift in that. It parallels a lot of the changes that we see in settings like the United States and Europe, where men have become more involved with childcare on average over the last few decades. But if we go back to the 80s and 90s, for boys, as adolescents, if they were living with their dads and their dads were involved with childcare, that's predictive of how their own testosterone changes when they become dads 10 or 15 years later. Oh. So if they were close to their dads, living with their dads, and their dads were involved with childcare, their testosterone goes down more when they transition to fatherhood themselves 10 or 15 years later. And it's only during adolescence that we pick up the signal. We are able to test virtually the same things with middle childhood and during infancy. And you don't see the same effects for those earlier time periods, which is actually somewhat not what you would predict based on animal models. So I think we would sort of predict that those earlier developmental sensitive periods might be more significant for some of this, the kind of biological programming effect, so to speak. Although folks like Megan Gunner and others have recently talked a lot about the importance of the pubertal transition in adolescence as a new or a sensitive period where the body, the brain, and key physiological systems like our endocrine axes can recalibrate based on kind of the social and physical conditions that we experience during that key life history phase. So, and that's what we tend to see in the context of our longitudinal study in the Philippines. So what I think, if we're thinking more generally about kind of what are the effects of the social and kind of emotional bonding profile that tends to be linked to lower testosterone and more kind of responsive oxytocin and higher prolactin in studies that have been done around the world, including by some of my colleagues here on the call, you know, what you would see is that in settings like the US, we know from a lot of developmental psychology work that children who grow up with dads who are more sensitive and warm and nurturing and consistent do better socially. They tend to thrive more academically. They tend to have better emotional regulation. And so all of those kind of social and cognitive characteristics that come along with having invested, committed caregivers, including dads, you know, are being translated or being expressed neurobiologically and psychobiologically. So I think those are the kind of signals that we see developmentally in terms of how the biology of fatherhood and the way that we've kind of characterized it can help shape the developmental trajectories of kids in different kinds of families in different contexts around the world. And I know I've been talking for a long time here now, so I'm going to cut myself off. But if Ruth were here, Ruth's lab has done a lot of really elegant work looking at mother, father, infant, and toddler triads and looking at how there are different kinds of interactions kind of across those developmental periods, not only are linked to different hormonal profiles in the moms and dads, but then how that also kind of tracks to physiological changes in the babies and the toddlers. And like one of the things that they showed in one of their really elegant studies was that if you have parents who have kind of higher oxytocin and they're more sensitive and nurturing, then you as a child end up having a more responsive and kind of upregulated oxytocin system. And that translates out to how you interact socially with your friends outside of your family. So again, it's kind of consistent with that overall model that I tried to lay out, but I definitely encourage looking up Ruth Feldman's lab's work on that topic.
Thank you very much. So before we start a second round of questions, I have a question directed to all of you and you know, whoever wants to have a try to answer it. Is hate ever adaptive? Clearly love is, but what about hate? Eduardo?
Yeah, try. Well, I will probably just be quoting Ruth. You're tapping on the same, if you're tapping on the same neurobiological substrates, these are, I mean, she was very courageous to talk about that. I think it was fantastic. And I suspect we all find it very, very difficult to talk about these things. But if we, for a moment, we leave humans aside, you see many of the behavioral manifestations that among humans we find horrific in all kinds of non-human animals all the time. Animals fight each other, animals kill each other. Animals have a very strong group belonging behavioral rules. So I think it wouldn't be coherent for most of us as we develop, articulate, and present to the Karta community an argument around the biological basis of love based on our understanding of behavioral patterns across humans and non-humans, that now we see those similar patterns for hate, but then what? So for hate, we're going to have a different kind of criteria and say, no, that cannot be biological. I say yes.
Thanks, Eduardo. Constantina and Karen, you both had your hands up. You want to add to that?
Yeah, of course. I think that with what Ruth's work brought to my mind was all this line of oxytocin work around how it plays out in different in-group versus out-group relationships, where oxytocin can be great for your in-groups, but work in an opposite fashion for discriminating outgroups. So I think if indeed hate is something that, or behaviors and the neurobiology of hate could be something that should be evolving as all the neurobiology for all the other rest of behaviors, the way or the framework through which I would see this is the population of people that we actually include in our in-group versus out-group. I think definitely there are characteristics of different types that are triggered because of different ways that make us consider other individuals, and I'm talking about humans and other species as well, make us consider them as in-groups or out-groups. So I think that one direct way to see how hate plays out and how it evolves is going through and really investigating which people with which characteristics in humans specific people consider as their in-groups or out-groups.
Karen Bales, you had your hand up too? No, okay. So we have a question for you next. Sue. Oh,
my turn. Okay, Karen, you briefly mentioned that you have looked at changes in seahorse brains.
Yes.
Do you know if a similar mechanism of social buffering exists in seahorses and voles, such as they caught your kappa opioid receptor dynorphin titty monkey story? I think that's, and if so, is there greater buffering by the female in all three species?
So we have not looked at social buffering in seahorses yet. It is on the list, the to-do list. What we have looked at is changes in the brain with the formation of a pair bond. And we have used publicly available lists of gene changes in various areas of prairie vole brain to do analyses where we've compared gene changes that, are parallel in seahorses and prairie voles. And it's really interesting to do that because there were genes that jumped out that we didn't expect. So, in addition to some of the, genes that you would expect, like, one's neuropeptides, for instance, there were changes in cilia related genes, for instance, which, I had, despite, occasionally referring to myself as a neuroscientist, I had managed to forget for many years that neurons have cilia and that they're a means of plasticity in neurons. So change in gene, a lot of these cilia related genes change in expression with pair bonding in both seahorses and in prairie voles. So, these are the kinds of things we're interested in. But as far as social buffering, we don't know yet for seahorses. They've been challenging. It turns out they're not really very good at being, fish. So they're hard to study. We have seen a lot of interesting things, including that are interesting with regards to things like sex determination as well. So that might complicate our interpretation. So for instance, when we leave a group of female seahorses together too long, some of them switch to being males. Just things you don't see as often in mammals. So it's been fun.
Fantastic. The next question is a pheromone question for Sue Carter. In animals, hormones, for example, oxytocin, act internally, while pheromones act externally to influence behavior. In addition, both oxytocin and pheromones are known to influence brain function in some animal species. However, in contrast to the well-established examples for the hormone oxytocin, as discussed today, in some primate species, the role of pheromones in human behavior is apparently still controversial. Can you address the current view of the role of pheromones in human love, pair bonding, mother-child attachment, and recognition?
Probably not. But I think we could open that question to this very educated panel, see if anybody wants to jump in. Pheromones, You know, there, let me put it this way, it's unfundable research. That's why I started my career, working on olfactory preferences and olfactory imprinting. And I would suggest it'll be at least 4 years before a study like that can be funded. But maybe somebody knows the answer already.
Any thoughts on the role of pheromones, the elusive ones? No shortage of marketing of them, but...
Yeah, there's...
Good. Well, let's move on to the next question, which is for Jim. I think, Sue, you have that question.
In your fMRI research on human social emotion, which emotional state has been the most challenging to measure? Have certain emotional responses proven particularly difficult to register or distinguish in neuroimaging?
What an interesting question. We've looked both at sort of positive and negative social emotions with some of our fMRI paradigms. And in particular, we've done a lot of work in the past with this task called the iterated prisoner's dilemma game, which is a task where you can either it's a dyadic social interaction task, and you play with another person and you cooperate, and they can either reciprocate that cooperation or not. And so when they reciprocate, that's generally rewarding to people. I think this is like 20 years ago, we were able to show that that the social reward that people get from that type of exchange more strongly activates the mesolimbic dopamine system than does receiving the equivalent amount of money in a non-social exchange. So I think that was kind of important. And that dopamine system is utilized for all kinds of positive social interactions with, not just cooperation, but I think for, parental care and things like that. But we've also looked at, for example, negative social interactions. So when, for example, you cooperate and someone fails to reciprocate that, and there, what we tend to see instead is activation in areas like the anterior insula and the amygdala, and those two areas kind of work together. The amygdala generally kind of triggering an autonomic arousal response, and then the insula is kind of like a visceral somatosensory cortex that tracks those changes in the state of the body, like kind of like a somatic marker. So we have a little bit of experience with both. I've been more oriented towards the positive things more recently in my career, and been doing a lot with grandmothers, and also a lot of work with fathers. Been able to show things like when fathers view a picture of their toddler child, the more strongly that activates their reward system, the more engaged they tend to be in taking care of that child in terms of instrumental care. So I'm not sure I fully answered your question, but I like the question. Those are some of my initial thoughts about it.
I think that was quite a good answer. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jim. The next question is for Eduardo. Have the overall number of owl monkey groups in the reserve remained stable over time? Or do new pairs ever form from two floaters, which don't involve displacing one of the members of a current pair?
Two different questions. The first one will in part answer the second one. The number of groups has remained, the number of groups / territories, so each group occupies a piece of land that more or less they have relatively exclusive access to it. The number of groups has remained stable in the area where we work. We have an endless number of groups. You just need to keep walking along the river. So most of our core work focuses on between 10 and 15 of these pair living groups, but some demographic data is done with 20, 25, 30 groups that we check less frequently. So in that sense, we have no evidence suggesting that the number of groups has changed in the area that we monitor year-round, every week, every month. Now, because of that, that's why I said that the first the first answer starts addressing the second question. We get the impression that our forest is saturated. We don't really have open areas. Every so often, we were talking about this with a team several months ago, and sometimes I like just asking independently, well, from the top of your head, if I ask you, how many times have we encountered in the forest two monkeys that look to us like two monkeys that are not members of a group? Marcelo, who's been working with our monkeys for 25 years, we don't get to 10 times when maybe we find what we call now a temporary association of two monkeys that we have all evidence to suggest these are two solitary floaters. We see them one day, we see them twice, and they are usually very quiet and somewhere in the periphery of the territory of one of the groups. And so one possibility is that these two animals, remember that there's so little sexual dimorphism, you cannot tell whether you're looking at two males, two females, or one of each. I mean, of course, we'll go there with our biases. You're assuming it ought to be a male and a female, God knows. But they never last. So never have we seen two solitary floaters forming a new pair and establishing themselves somewhere else, which is something that going back to how it is true that we have titis analogies in South America, but you do have other primates that live in pairs. I mean, I'm thinking of the gibbons, the siamangs, and there have been papers, there have been research by colleagues describing how instances in which actually in titi monkeys, there's a paper a few days ago where one of the offspring apparently established a territory, kind of a bud off a territory out of its parents' territory. We've never seen that. Really, it is, you leave mom and dad, you go on your own, you float, and you try to make your way into a group through, our impression is always through aggression. But again, talking about all the biases, Sue was talking about the challenges of measuring receptors. For us, the challenge is that it is so much easier to collect positive data than negative data. So if the animal moves in aggressively, it's more conspicuous, animals get hurt, animals die. If there's a peaceful transition, if there's a peaceful swapping of wife or husband, we may not notice.
Thank you. We have a question for Ruth, and she's answered it. She is so efficient, I swear. What would be a situation where vasopressin or oxytocin would be interchanged, and is there a biological advantage to this interchangeability? So we're back to hormones, and here's Ruth's answer, which I have the honor of reading. Oxytocin, the system that supports bonding, also functions to calm us down in order to initiate the state of relaxation needed for bond formation, particularly in mothers, and increases approach behavior, which in humans expanded into multiple states such as trust, engagement, and empathy. But also, oxytocin also lulls our vigilance to potential danger while adapting a trusting approach. In contexts of chronic stress, danger, war, and ongoing trauma, there is survival advantage to temper the oxytocin approach with healthy vigilance, and this comes from vasopressin. It's the male bonding hormone implicated in territorial defense, aggression to protect loved ones, and vigilance. At times of chronic danger, this interchangeability of the two systems is advantageous and may occur more readily. And I agree with her. I also, though, would like to, we haven't drawn Karen Parker in as much as we should. And I have a question I'm wondering, Karen, this kind of off of that last question, why does or how does vasopressin do what it's doing in a child who has an autistic phenotype or behavioral? What do you think? Could you kind of dig into that for a second? It's really the same question that Ruth was asked.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, some of this, I think, is an artifact of marketing, right? Like, there's been a lot of marketing around these hormones, of oxytocin being the good hormone and vasopressin being the bad hormone. And so I think one of the tricky parts is often people don't measure both within a given experiment. And so there aren't these rigorous head-to-head comparisons that need to happen. I think there's other issues like, where do you measure it, right? Are you measuring it in the brain, or are you measuring it in blood? You alluded to the fact that there's a lot of disagreement about how to even measure these hormones. I think it makes a difference if you are, if you're thinking about vasopressin in the context of, is the vasopressin signaling system intact or is it impaired? Right. And so giving vasopressin to an individual who has impaired vasopressin signaling, like what we've found repeatedly in autism, may mean something very different than a vole that has intact vasopressin signaling or a hamster. And, you know, and I think the other tricky part is, how do we think about this species typical behaviors, right? If you have a hamster, so some of the early work, as you well know, was done in hamsters that were asocial, and the only things in their social repertoire were sex and fighting. And, you know, if you don't pair bond, if you don't engage in paternal care, if you put vasopressin, super physiological amounts of vasopressin into a hamster that has intact vasopressin signaling, and the only thing that it has available in its repertoire that's social is fighting, you know, that's something very different than putting it into a male who pair bonds. And so I think that's one piece. I think the second piece is, you know, this marketing part, right? Like, so people have alluded to the idea that vasopressin is involved in aggression, but it depends on who, you know, what's the perspective. If you're the mate, you're, you know, the male is defending you, right? Or if you're a pup, the male is defending you. And that's actually a pro-social interaction. If it's a marauding male who's coming to go kill your babies, arguably that's a pro-social action to defend your mate and offspring. And so, you know, mothers can be extremely aggressive when they have oxytocin in their brains, but we never talk about that, right? And so I think we need to have more honest conversations about what these molecules do. When we run our studies, we always measure both, right? And I think the other thing is, because these ligands and receptors can be so promiscuous, meaning that they bind to each other's receptors, if you're not administering antagonists to understand, you know, which receptors these molecules are binding to, we actually don't know what's really going on, right? And so I think there's a lot we don't know.
Well, Karen, there are vasopressin V1A antagonists, which people thought would treat autism, and they didn't, as far as I'm aware. A couple of companies have made them, Roche and the one that Neil Simon, the company Neil Simon runs. Have you considered giving, I know it's a little invasive for humans, but have you considered giving those to the children at the same time you give them extra vasopressin? Do you understand that?
Yeah, I mean, that would assume they'd actually let you have access to their molecules, right? And I actually said, why don't we do this in our monkey model? I said, give me your drug. I've actually spoken to the people at Roche and said, hey, you know, maybe, like, let's be generous in thinking about this. Maybe there's an optimal band of vasopressin functioning, and mm-hmm. autism is extremely clinically heterogeneous. So maybe there are individuals where a V1A receptor antagonist is actually going to be useful. And then there might be other individuals where an agonist would be useful. They refuse to give me their drug. And then the other thing I would say is, their trials were terminated in you know, because of, they ran futility analyses and their medication wasn't working. And yeah. So I think It wasn't ever clear to me what the basis of spending $2 billion on Balovaptan was, but they're no longer investigating it in the context of autism, to my understanding.
Well, this is, yeah. Yes,
I have
you're
a follow-up for Karen with regard to male and female differences. Do they have different baselines of vasopressin than are there differences between males and females of either the levels of vasopressin or the density or expression of the receptor proteins?
In general or in the context of autism?
In humans in general, as a baseline, outside of autism.
Well, I mean, again, this comes back to where do you measure the, where do you measure oxytocin or vasopressin, right? And if you're measuring it in blood, I mean, like there are very well-defined physiological roles of these molecules in blood, right? And they may have nothing to do with social functioning, right? And so we it's very difficult. I mean, it's not something that's tractable, I think, for every study, but we have tried to look at CSF because that's a better biochemical readout of brain function. And but again, that's very difficult to do, and it's incredibly hard to get people to go in to do a lumbar puncture, other than outside the context of, sort of a clinically indicated medical need. And so I think until we can develop technologies where we can non-invasively measure what's going on in the brain, especially like PET ligands, like that is desperately needed in this field. And we keep coming up empty whenever people sink a lot of money into it. And I think that's really the only path forward.
Thank you very much. I think, Sue, you have a question for Konstantina.
Konstantina. If oxytocin is indeed critical for the social motivation of vocal learning, what are the potential implications for speech therapy or interventions in children with speech and language disorders, such as autism spectrum disorder? We're back to our favorite disease. So, Konstantina, what do you
Of
think?
course,
You've thought about
right.
it, I know.
So one way to see this hypothesis is that it's basically the idea that we're testing now in autistic children, being that, well, oxytocin might be playing important roles in these brain pathways that impinge onto neurons in the vocal sensory motor brain pathways, and basically activate those systems when they need to be activated, and as much as they need to get activated during vocal learning development or even later in development. So one way to see this is that maybe someone who is lacking, let's say, the level of oxytocin needed to do that would be benefited by an oxytocin agonist administration. So this is the study that we're running. Of course, since oxytocin has been already been cleared for specific age frames, and also autism has a more or less starting diagnosis age at about 5 years old. It is not possible to study in humans how oxytocin would help infant vocal development. But what we are doing is that with a starting diagnosis age of 5 years old, we administer an oxytocin agonist. And we then expose these children to sounds and words of novel languages. Namely, if the child's native language is English, we expose them to words that are made up of sounds that are Chinese or Ukrainian or Greek, you name it. And we tell them to repeat these words multiple different times in a randomized order. And then we have them go a washout period of 4 weeks, and then they come back, they get placebo instead of oxytocin. Of course, all this is in a controlled randomized fashion. We don't know who is getting what and who is getting what first and what second. And we give them placebo and see in a similar vocal learning paradigm how placebo would affect this speech their sorry how it would affect their performance in this speech imitation task. So what the hypothesis is that oxytocin would be helpful for speech imitation. Another thing to say this is from a behavioral perspective, namely all this field of oxytocin and social reward has given us more than enough information about the specific behaviors, such as social bonding behaviors, social play, that actually elicit the secretion of oxytocin. So another way to say this behaviorally would be, well, the speech therapy field should really be aware of the importance of the social interaction, social bonding techniques that could fit into the speech therapy intervention. Because what several autistic children, but also people from other spectrum very often complain about is that speech therapy includes several very repetitive drills that are really just very tiresome. Also, adds to this the fact that people with language deficits, they actually, during speech therapy, they actually hear themselves do something that they perceive constantly that they don't do well. They know which is the target and they don't produce something that really resembles often the target. So they get constant error signals. So what we need there is to really kind of fill this experience as much as we can up with as many reward signals. And if this is social reward, well, I guess even better. That's my take.
Interesting. Thank you very much. The next question is for Lee Gettler. I wonder, it might be from a concerned father. Are there potential trade-offs for fathers who experience significant testosterone declines in terms of relational or behavioral outcomes? For instance, could lower testosterone, while beneficial for nurturing behavior, negatively affect relationship dynamics with partners?
So I do think there are some trade-offs in the context of industrial and kind of post-industrial societal settings related to health that I think are important to discuss and not ignore. I'll loop back to that. I'll try to answer the more specific part first. What we saw in the work that I presented in the Republic of the Congo from these two neighboring societies with different, very different models of family life, is that when fathers have lower testosterone, they're ranked as having less conflict with their partners. This type of finding has been found really consistently across a diverse array of societies, mostly in the United States and Europe, but where lower testosterone in male partners is linked with lower conflicts, more relationship satisfaction, more perceived commitment from the partner. So in general, lower testosterone in the context of partner relationships tends to be related to higher relationship satisfaction. So we don't see a lot of evidence that there are trade-offs, at least for most couples and for most men in those kinds of committed partnerships. The caveat to that is that low testosterone, clinically low testosterone, is a risk factor for depression. And there is some evidence that there's work. I mentioned Robin Edelstein in my talk. She collaborates really closely with another really excellent scholar named Darby Saxby. And Darby and Robin have shown work that for new dads in the early postpartum period, for some of them, low testosterone is a risk factor for depressive symptoms. But in the same study population, low testosterone in dads is linked to some of those positive outcomes in their partners in terms of them feeling better supported, them feeling like the dads are contributing more, them feeling more satisfied. And so some of this is individual differences in terms of how those low testosterone profiles play out and their effects on emotional function and risk factors for things like depression. But I do think for some men, there's this biological capacity that we've documented that testosterone can go down in men during their partner's pregnancies and as they transition to that early postpartum period. And if their testosterone kind of declines too much for some men, that's going to be a risk factor for depressive symptoms. So I think men should be aware of that there's a lot of potential positives that come along with this biological fatherhood and these biological capacities, but there can be risk factors for mental health as well. And we should encourage men to seek out help if they're feeling symptoms of depression in the postpartum period, because it's pretty neglected in fathers and it's really much more common than I think people understand. And then the other thing that we've explored using large nationally representative data sets from the US Centers for Disease Control is that partnered men who are living with fathers at a national level have lower, significantly lower testosterone than single men who aren't living with kids. And they also have a lot more fat around their bellies, and their lower testosterone helps explain that kind of phenomenon of having more belly fat, particularly probably visceral fat, which is negative, particularly negative form of adiposity for long-term health risks. So we affectionately referred to this paper as the dad bod paper, but we need more support for families. I had two kids. I have two kids. They're 8 and 10, but one of my kids didn't sleep for 3 years. My first one. It's amazing we even had to. And it was really hard to take care of myself and for my partner to take care of herself during that period. It was just really challenging. So I don't want to sound kind of overly trite and just saying we need to encourage dads to try to get sleep and eat healthy and exercise. But I think it is really important for men to understand that their bodies are potentially changing in these ways that can be really beneficial, but they're also can be downsides if they're not able to kind of attend to their health in other ways.
Yeah, thank you. I have a follow-up question for you that I bet you hasn't been done. Has anyone looked at prostate disease in men as a function of this question in general? Because you might predict protection there by lower testosterone.
Yeah, so I think, and I don't want to misspeak, so what I think is that there have been some there are analyses of large data sets that come from organizations like the AARP and things like that, that have looked at in other big data sets that have mortality and morbidity data for older adults. And I believe there's a kind of U-shaped curve with fatherhood and prostate cancer risk, where if you have a couple of kids, your prostate risk is lower than if you have no kids, but it actually, it kind of tracks back up a little bit as you have more kids. That's certainly true of mortality risks for men living in the United States, but I think some of that work has been done on prostate cancer specifically. But I don't think the explanatory kind of framework for it in those studies is they're not thinking about these kind of testosterone-related changes, but it could be a contributing factor.
So the next one is for Jim Rilling, and as follows: is it safe to say that oxytocin is more of an anti-inflammatory neurotransmitter than a love hormone? Perhaps love is not about the need for attachment, but a stress reduction response to ensure the survival of the individual.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it does all those things, right? And so we know it has anti-inflammatory effects, and I learned about that from Sue, actually. She wrote a great article about all the anti-aging properties of oxytocin. And we know it has anxiolytic effects, which, I agree with the questioner that can facilitate approaching others if we have less anxiety. And it clearly also seems to be about attachment. And I think probably most fundamentally about social reward and about the motivation to approach and care for offspring and others. So I just think it has all of those effects. Thank you.
Pleiotropy is the name of the game.
Yeah.
Sue, I think you have a question for Lee next.
No, I just asked it about the it hasn't shown up yet. I have one open to all. Is
please,
that
please?
Which I couldn't answer. So let's see. With the recent studies on the movement of the SRY gene from the Y chromosome to chromosome number 3, and the prediction of the Y chromosome shrinking, can we conduct these studies on oxytocin and vasopressin on a generalized level as opposed to male versus female brains? Another incredibly sophisticated question, so go for it, folks. Who's up on the chromosome story?
I only want to share, because some of you may not be aware, I have nothing to comment on the question, but the Almaki species that I study has a karyotype N2N50 and 2N49 for the males. The males have a transposed Y chromosome. I just throw out there in case anybody wants to follow up with me. Give you the paper that was published describing the karyotype for Eotus. But the Y chromosome, Pascal may remember more about this, but the Y chromosome is completely translocated to an arm of the X chromosome or something like that.
So this is indeed a really interesting topic, because we know that mammals have genetic sex determination, whereby the cascade of sex development is triggered in a very binary way by the SRY gene. That SRY gene can jump onto other chromosomes, but you will not be able to make any sperm, even though you phenotypically you look male, because all the 106 genes on the Y chromosome will not be present if your SRY is on the X or on another chromosome. So the question seems motivated by, you know, a very healthy reaction to what seems a very binary presentation of vasopressin oxytocin systems. Mm-hmm. And I look to the experts here to think aloud about how, despite the a lot of evidence of a binary pattern, and think of the 4-to-1 ratio of autism spectrum between boys and girls, that screams biological, you know, sex differences. But it's a justified question to think, well, is that a trap that we're being sucked in because we're too binary? Yeah, you guys go help me out.
I would say this is another workshop. Not this one turned into an oxytocin vasopressin workshop somewhat. And I suggest
that, I mean, I think we all recognize that these variables are continuous. And I think where we have fallen down in our science is that we almost never measure them continuously. So we all talk about them as binary still. I just think that that's part of our challenge in moving forward, is to prospectively design our studies so that we can in future be able to talk about these concepts with data, right? And have continuous data instead of binary data. That's all we have in most of these circumstances, even though we know that that's not correct.
Agreed. And I would agree with Sue that, you know, the topic of sexual dimorphism is so gigantic, not just for neurobiology, but for everything, that, you know, I very much look forward to a potential future Carter Symposium on the role of sexual dimorphism and, you know, in human origins.
I think what we've done here today is uncover some of the world's most interesting questions, okay? Questions about chromosomes, questions about sex, questions about fatherhood, quite a bit more consensus than I expected in the way that people are thinking, because each of you was chosen. I feel like one of those bizarre movies, you know, we've brought you together and we haven't told you how you got here. only Pascal and I know, but it wasn't a terribly logical process, but the patterns that I see coming out of this research, and I'm sorry, Ruth's not here to kind of capstone this with us, are extremely, there's an extreme amount of consistency in the way people have been thinking about this. And I agree with Karen Parker, we may be led down a path that's not totally accurate because, and I'm guilty of this, I've written now since I started writing these papers saying it's not just oxytocin in the 1990s, but no one was listening because they wanted to hear that oxytocin was the answer to all the world's problems. And it may be, but I don't know, but it's not that simple. And that's what I think we've learned here today. We have some underlying themes and amazing creativity in this assemblage, this unusual assemblage of people, many of whom have never met each other before. But we've also opened a lot of portals, if you will, that haven't been explored. So that's my wrap up. I don't know. I think Pascal gets the last word.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. I really want to make sure that you appreciate how much I'm grateful for all of you participating. I totally agree with Sue that we've opened a lot of really interesting questions. Many of you have highlighted how humans sit at this intersection where the culture is pushing the biology and the biology is pushing the culture. And many of us might disagree what is more important, but the reality seems to be they're firmly embedded. And we are probably the species that has this incredible, profound interaction between our culture and our biology, whether it's what the fathers do in neighboring tribes or what grandmothers do in different societies in different centuries. It has effects on the biology. And of course, the biology unfolds on its own as well within the cultural environment. So I'd like to thank all of you for your excellent talks. I'd like to thank the audience. Over 300 people have tuned in, and the excellent questions you've submitted. I apologize in advance for those in the audience whose question didn't make it to discussion. Thank you all again. These symposia are made possible by your support. So if you want more of these, we had several ideas for future symposia, consider supporting us. Thank you all to the speakers, to the audience, and I look forward to seeing you at future symposia. The next one will be virtual on mismatch, human origins and modern disease in May 16th. And then in fall, we will have an in-person one at the Salk Institute, Ancient DNA, New Revelations 10 Years After.
Oh, fantastic. I have to thank the staff of CARTA, since I am not a member. And of course, Pascal is wonderful to work with. That has to be the last word. Thank you, Pascal. Thank you for CARTA, the CARTA team.
Bye. Take care. Thank you all.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.